From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we'll rebroadcast some of our favorite conversations later in this show. Historian Craig Wilder reveals the relationship between slavery and modern-day capitalism. Earth, Wind, and Fire's Verdeen White reflects on his brother Maurice's legacy. And actor Jeremy Irons talks about his role in the film The Man Who Knew Infinity. But first, according to my next guest, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, children who are repeatedly exposed to the stress of abuse and neglect are at greater risk of struggling with chronic health illnesses like depression and cancer later in life. Dr. Burke-Harris has developed an innovative way to address these challenges. She is the founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness and talks to us more about it right now. Dr. Burke-Harris, good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
Let me start by asking the obvious, I guess, which is whether or not a stressful childhood can make you sick.
And the answer is yes.
Yes. Okay.
But there's stress and then there's stress.
Okay.
Right? And so what we're talking about is stress that's so severe, chronic, or pervasive that it literally gets under your skin and changes our biology.
Mm. Tell me how that works.
Yeah. So when we think about things like abuse or neglect or growing up in a household where a parent is mentally ill or substance dependent, mm-hmm. every time a child is exposed to a situation that is scary or terrifying, it activates their stress response. You and I are familiar with the stress response, mm-hmm. right? It's, you know, a dog jumps out from behind a bush, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Your heart starts to beat, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And that happens because there are chemicals and hormones in our body that are released. Now, in children, if that happens too frequently, if that happens over and over and over again, those hormones change the way a child's brain and body develop and function moving forward.
And by child, you're talking what ages here?
So the big research study that was done by the CDC and Kaiser looked at folks 0 to 18,
okay.
so asked folks about traumas that they experience anytime from the time they were 0 to 18 years old.
All right. So I hear your point that if this happens too frequently, mm-hmm. it can change the way that brains develop. Is there no way to arrest that in that period or thereafter?
There is. Yeah. There's actually a lot that we can do.
Okay.
The most important thing that we can do is early detection, mm-hmm. right? We all know that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Mm-hmm.
And the earlier we detect, then we have the opportunity to take advantage of the child's developing brain and body to have that development happen in a healthy environment as opposed to an unhealthy environment. But even if it's detected later in life, mm-hmm. there are six things that the research shows us are the most effective things to undo the effects of trauma on developing brain and body.
Mm-hmm.
And those are sleep, exercise, nutrition, mindfulness like meditation, mm-hmm. mental health interventions, and healthy relationships.
Mm-hmm. So 2 seconds ago, you introduced the word environment into this conversation, which
yes.
leads me to ask how much environment impacts the reality that you're talking about now? And are there certain people who are more susceptible to being in environments that make that are more conducive, sadly, to this kind of bad development?
Yeah, so we are learning about that quite a bit. And mm-hmm. what the science shows us is that our health, right, our biology is a result of both nature mm-hmm. and nurture, mm-hmm. Both our genetics and our environment. And in fact, our environment changes the way that our genes are read and expressed, right?
Mm.
So environment actually changes our biology through a series of mechanisms. And what we now understand is that it's possible that some folks are more susceptible. For example, we see that, you know, folks in the population, they come, there's lots of different heights,
mm-hmm.
right? Some people are super tall, some mm-hmm. people are just naturally on the shorter side. Similarly, folks have a normal variation in stress tolerance,
mm-hmm.
right? Some can tolerate high stress, and some have very little stress, and that pushes them over the edge into disease.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot that we can do with environment to be able to buffer stress,
mm-hmm.
right? So one of the coolest things about this science is that we are now demonstrating that as humans, we have the ability to buffer each other's stress response. biologically, right? So we know I'm a new mother, right? And as a mother, I know that my relationship with my baby, when he cries, I know it's time for me to nurse, right? We have these relationships. And similarly, we have the ability to affect each other's biology through healing and nurturing relationships.
Tell me more. I'm fascinated now and intrigued. Tell me more about how that would work. So person A is trying to assist person B. How does the interaction, the relationship work or benefit?
Yeah, so this is actually part of the way that humans have evolved is that when a child is in a scary environment, it activates their stress response and they release hormones like adrenaline and cortisol. Now, if they are in the presence of a caring, nurturing, buffering adult, what happens is that the adult is able to help them make meaning of the situation, help them feel safe, and those hormonal levels are able to return to normal, right? Without the presence of that buffering, caring adult, those hormone levels can actually stay elevated. And what we see in children, for example, some children in foster care populations or children who have been exposed to chronic trauma is that we see that their bodies release higher spikes of adrenaline and have changes in the pattern of their cortisol regulation. But when those children, for example, research of kids who have been adopted internationally, when those children are able to get into a safe, stable, nurturing environment over the long term, we can actually see correction of those biological changes over time.
So that if some child in some part of the world where they're catching hell is adopted by an American family, we see this every day to your point, so Americans adopt babies from around the world, they come here and presumably have a better life, more opportunities, those stress factors you mentioned, so we assume tend to go down for those babies.
Yes.
But what about those babies born in this country?
Yes.
Who are, you know where I'm going with this, of course.
Yes.
Who are living in environments where they're not just exposed to some stress, the environment itself is the quintessential definition of stress.
Yes.
There are gunshots going off every night. There's arguing, there's fighting, there's poverty, there's lack. Mm-hmm. What chance does that child have?
So this is really interesting. This is the work that brought me to this science, right? I discovered this science when I came to work in the Bayview Hunters Point community of San Francisco, which is a community that does have gunshots and violence and drug deals happening on the corner. And there are a couple things that are really critically important. One is that if you have a healthy and intact caregiver, even in adverse circumstances, the child will do well if the caregiver is supported and does well. So for example, at our center, the Center for Youth Wellness, in partnership with the clinic that we work with, the Bayview Child Health Center, when we provide services to kids, we do what we call two-generation work. We're not only taking care of the child, we're also supporting and caring for the caregiver, because we have to not only reduce the dose of adversity that the child is experiencing, but also support the caregiver to be an effective buffer.
Sure.
We also know that some communities experience greater doses of adversity than others. So the major research studies have looked at 10 specific categories, which is, you know, physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, physical and emotional neglect, or having a parent who's mentally ill, incarcerated, substance dependent, separated or divorced, or experiencing domestic violence. But we also know that in communities where certain individuals are more likely to be targeted by the police, for example, or where folks feel like it's simply unsafe to go outside, that those individuals experience higher, you know, what we call total dose of trauma. And that also affects their stress response system. And the biggest place we see this is in behavior and learning, right? So I came across this work when a lot of teachers were referring kids to me for what they thought was ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But when I actually did a thorough physical exam, you know, what I saw was that these kids had a dysregulated stress response.
It does not surprise me. Sad, but it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
particularly when that wrong diagnosis ends up putting them on medication.
That's not
treating the problem that they're suffering from in the first place.
That's exactly right.
But I digress on that. I got 30 seconds to go very quickly. It occurred to me as you were talking that the flip side of these perhaps black and brown kids, shall we say, in these high stress environments who get misdiagnosed, as we said a moment ago, the flip side of that is the children of wealthy parents who might not be black or brown, who are also enduring a different kind of stress, the stress of expectation, the stress of I can do this all day long, I'm out of time. What do you say to those parents? So again, it occurs to me that you don't have to be a poor kid to be under stress.
So that's absolutely true. The original Kaiser CDC study was done in a population 70% Caucasian, 70% college educated. This is all of us.
Yeah, I get it. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris doing great work. Good to have you on the program. Thanks for sharing that.
Thank you.
Good to come back because I got a lot more questions for you.
Okay.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Georgetown University president recently announced that the institution would take steps to atone for its ownership of slaves by, amongst other things, creating an institute for the study of slavery. This move has reignited a conversation about the roots of capitalism. A collection of essays called Slavery's Capitalism, A New History of American Economic Development, provides new insights into the topic. Historian and author Craig Wilder contributed to the collection and shares his thoughts with us now. Professor Wilder, good to have you on this program, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start with the story that everybody's been talking about of late. You probably know where I'm going here, the Georgetown story.
Yep.
For those who haven't followed that, just give a synopsis of what's happened at Georgetown and what decision they've made of late that people are kind of fascinated by.
Well, what's happened is the university, actually the undergraduate students, and particularly black students on campus, have been protesting and moving to get the university to recognize its long history with slavery. And one of the points that has really galvanized attention has been the sale of 272 people in 1838. Georgetown and the Jesuits in Maryland sold 272 slaves from Maryland to Louisiana, in part to help finance the university and rescue it, solve its debts and rescue it out of financial trouble. And that's now coming back to really, Georgetown is now facing that moment and trying to deal with the legacy of that moment on its campus and in its alumni community.
And the president essentially announced that Georgetown would do what?
Well, Jack DeJoy, the president of Georgetown, announced that that the descendants of the 272 people would actually have special admission status at Georgetown. They made other gestures towards sort of a compensatory justice for the 1838 moment, including, you know, committing to a center for the study of race and slavery, trying to diversify the faculty and the undergraduate student body.
There are a lot of people, and I have heard and seen folk on both sides of this, as I'm sure you have.
Right.
There are a lot of folk who give the president great, great credit. For a bold and innovative and creative move, the likes of which no other institution has ever done. So he gets high marks from a lot of people, and yet there are others raising the question about why there is no money, no compensation going directly to those family members who are still living, those descendants. Where do you come down on that?
Well, you know, the only institution that's come even close is Brown University in 2006 under Ruth Simmons, right?
Exactly.
Her leadership. And she really created the template for how a university, and particularly a historically white university, can deal with this kind of a situation. I actually think that Jack DeJoy's statement deserves some credit. This is the first time where a university is actually taking sort of direct responsibility for its history with slavery and actually committing to the descendants of the enslaved. I don't think that the actions that were taken in the president's address are sufficient to close this conversation. In fact, I actually think about it differently. What the president of Georgetown did that day when he stood up with that address was he began a conversation with the descendants of the people who were sold in 1838, but also a new conversation with black Americans about Georgetown opening a dialogue with African Americans, which begins, in fact, with those steps, but won't end until really the full history of Georgetown's relationship to slavery is understood. And it's much bigger than the 1838 moment.
When you think of the word, the term reparations, what do you make of it? How do you define it? How ought we approach it? It's a big question, but talk to me about reparations.
You know, I've been on the historian side of this for so long, and so I've always seen my job as providing people who engaged in these discussions with the kind of mm-hmm. information that they need for those discussions to be fair fights. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to our society. We actually need a kind of honest debate and not one that's shrouded in myth and an absence of fact, right? Yeah. The pretend facts that we often mm-hmm. use, right? And so for me, reparations is really about, in fact, a nation and a people coming to terms with its past in the most difficult moments in its past. And it includes, in fact, all sorts of actions. At Georgetown, I think one of the issues is the 1838 moment has gotten a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. But Georgetown University actually was funded by slavery for 50 years before 1838. Mm-hmm. Right from its founding in 1789 through 1838, it's tuition free mm-hmm. throughout that whole period, like Catholic universities were. Mm-hmm. And the sources of funds came from the slaves on the Maryland plantations. Mm-hmm. The Jesuits were funding themselves in the United States and in British North America for 200 years before 1838. And so there's a lot more history to be done before we get a full picture of the scale of the damage done. And the scale of the relationship between American slavery and American institutions.
Yep. So that is slavery and education, or the institution of education, principally Georgetown University. Right. Let's talk now about the link between slavery and capitalism.
Right.
What is it that this book is challenging us to rethink about that relationship?
I think the book does a few things. Mm-hmm. You know, for a long time, black scholars in the Atlantic world have made the argument that slavery was critical to the rise of modern capitalism, mm-hmm. you know, that the British Industrial Revolution doesn't happen without West Indian slavery, mm-hmm. That the United States' rise is dependent upon the slave system of the South. But mainstream historical accounts often dismiss that body mm-hmm. of work, and typically argued, in fact, that slavery was somewhat tangential, that it was a regional institution in the American South, and while it's important to the story of the South, it's not critical to the story of the rise of the United States. And what's happening is, in the past 20 years, you've started to get a revolution in the way that historians look at slavery. And slavery has become central to explaining the rise of the United States and the rise of American capitalism. And so one of the things that slavery's capitalism does is it actually locates the features of capitalism, things that we think are sort of critical in defining capitalist institutions, mm-hmm. and actually finds their origins in slavery, not in capitalism. And so, for instance, the insurance industry mm-hmm. And the rise of an insurance economy rooted in insuring literally life insurance for slaves so that you could actually protect yourself against losses. The mortgage industry. And the use of mortgages on slaves, or in other words, one of the essays in the book actually shows that Southern slave owners could actually mortgage their slaves and use the money from the mortgage to buy additional slaves, so that the value of the person, you didn't have to sell the person to get their value, you could actually mortgage the person and then use the loan to expand your lands and your slaveholding. And in fact, the expansion of cotton slavery in the South is an expansion, you know, from Virginia and the Carolinas and Georgia westward into Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. That's an expansion that's actually driven by new market and new credit market techniques and new finance systems that are, in fact, the basis for what we think of as financial capitalism.
None of this shocks me, and I'm not naive in asking this, but how is it that historians could have such a blind spot for so long? I mean, I'm not a historian, and clearly one with half a brain has to know that slavery was not tangential to U.S. capitalism.
Right. I think there are multiple things. I think one of the problems is that we tend to look for what we planned on seeing, mm-hmm. right? That you're actually predisposed to a certain view of the United States. Mm-hmm. And the United States for a long time has actually had a rather interesting creation story, which doesn't begin in the South and it doesn't begin in the 19th century. It actually begins, in the 18th century. Much of it is in the North as slavery recedes from the Northern states. New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania go through their abolition processes. One of the things that happens is local families, local historians, town and county historians begin writing the story of slavery. And very often slavery is either minimized, its importance is diminished within family histories, within regional and county histories, within city histories, state histories, and ultimately in national history. And so I think part of it is actually that historians were predisposed to a certain view of the world. But I also think history is often a political project. Right, that history is often at the center of the political, economic, and social fights that we're having. And so versions of the past are particularly important to informing how we view the present.
So we, speaking of the president, Professor, we live in a moment now where I think we agree there's too much poverty, too much income inequality, too little economic mobility. And so I guess the question is, what is the takeaway for African Americans in particular? And what is the takeaway from this text for the entire country? Again, and I wonder if you can situate that in a moment where capitalism doesn't seem to be working for so many of us anyway.
You know, I think this is actually part of what's changed in the past 20 years. You know, I think if you look at events like the celebration of the end of the slave trade in Britain just a decade ago, the New York Historical Society exhibits on slavery in New York, which had record-breaking attendance.
Yeah,
the public's attitude and willingness to listen and to hear a different version of the story of the United States is one of the things that's actually moving and helping to move this scholarship forward. For Black Americans, I hope that, you know, when we look at books like this, we see a few things. One is that the way in which African Americans have actually protected the past and forced themselves back into the American narrative demanded, generation after generation, that their contributions to the United States actually be respected and known, is actually finally starting to get embraced by the mainstream of academia. And I think that's fantastic. That's a wonderful transformation.
Yeah. Finally, are there persons right now who have taken the place of African Americans who are now making the kind of contribution to this country where their economic output is being taken for granted?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I can start listing them, right? Undocumented workers in the United States, the people who we disparage and often campaign against in our politics, the people who we like to blame for our economic problems without actually understanding the way in which economies work in a much more holistic way. I think the folks who are incarcerated in American prisons and who work free or near free for for-profit corporations in that context, the whole industry that we have created in incarcerating people. You know, the next American story, the one that comes after us, has the potential to be as devastating as this one if we don't correct our ways.
The new text is called Slavery's Capitalism, A New History of American Economic Development. Some powerful and beautiful essays in this piece I think you'll be enlightened by giving it a reading. Professor, good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming by to see us, brother.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Known for its boundary-defying music, the band Earth, Wind, and Fire is one of the most popular and influential bands of the 20th century. Earlier this year, the band's co-founder, Maurice White, passed away after a long battle with Parkinson's. His memoir, My Life with Earth, Wind, and Fire, was published, and his brother, Verdeen White, a member of Earth, Wind, and Fire, joins us now to talk about Maurice's legacy and this moving text.
Before our conversation, though, Earth, Wind, and Fire, performing one of my favorites, September, in Japan, 1994.
See, I love talking to you, but I hate to talk and interrupt that man. Hey, the whole stage was bouncing, man. There are some songs that you all perform and the place just goes nuts.
Go nuts. Yeah. They still go nuts over September.
The energy on that thing is just so. You cannot go to a concert, an Elements concert, and hear that and stay in your seat.
No, you can't. It's it's one of the most played songs in the history of songs.
Yeah.
And young people, older people, it's everywhere. It's in weddings. Yeah. It's in everything. Yeah. Everything.
Let me ask you to set your modesty aside. He was your brother, obviously. Mm-hmm. He is your brother, and forever will be. Mm-hmm. But what do you make of what Maurice was able to do with this band?
First of all, I don't know what was in his head. I think he was destined to do it.
Yeah.
I think, you know, he always had it inside of him as a child, and it was something he always wanted to do, and he had that energy and that drive.
Yeah.
And he saw things other people didn't see.
Yeah.
You know, particularly like musically, culturally, because, you know, this is also a journey through culture.
Sure.
You know, it's not just only a journey through music, it's a journey of his life,
yeah.
And it's a journey through the culture of music, you
yeah.
know, and I think he wanted to express that yeah. to people.
As a fan, mm-hmm. let me apologize, you just a bunch of fan questions I have
that That's
I,
all right.
I want to jump into.
That's okay.
Because we know so much about the music, we all love the music of the Elements. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's a fan of Earth, Wind & Fire, as I am, knows that Maurice somewhere, somehow, was turned on by curious about astrology.
Right.
It shows up in the music. Where did that curiosity and interest in astrology come from?
I think with him, you know, he always was a seeker, and he
yeah.
was always way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
And I think his ideas about the universe and spirituality and things, of course, that are normal today, yoga,
yeah.
meditation,
sure.
things like that.
He was way ahead of his time.
Way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
And he introduced that a lot to us as well as the rest of the world. So I think that was his way of being able to expand his mind. And then don't forget now him being originally a jazz drummer.
Yeah.
And you know, jazz was always a way out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They always had
yeah.
different ideas about a lot of different things. And I think he picked up on that.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, we were one of the first groups to travel across the whole world,
yeah, yeah.
and which was always in his vision,
yeah.
you know.
A lot of folk who don't know Maurice's past don't know, to your point, Navradeen,
mm-hmm.
What a true jazz artist he was as a drummer. This guy
right.
used to play with Ramsey Lewis.
That's right.
Yeah.
He was with Ramsey Lewis for like 5 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, Wade in the Water, In Crowd. But before that, you know, he was the session drummer at Chess Records.
Yeah.
On all those mm-hmm. hit records, you know, those 45s. And that's where he met the late Charles Stepney, and that's where he met Ramsey.
Yeah.
And Ramsey invited him to be in the trio. And then I think once Reese traveled around and he saw how the world was changing and how music could be part of that, I think
yeah.
that's where he got a lot of his ideas.
Tell me more about how his jazz background influenced his work, his writing, and these other genres of music.
Well, you hear a lot of his work, like in tunes like Can't Hide Love,
mm-hmm.
you know, all those great chords,
mm-hmm.
that vamp on the end.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it in After the Love Is Gone,
mm-hmm.
commercially,
sure.
with great choruses and hooks. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, don't forget now, he was a session drummer, so he learned how to play commercial songs,
right.
commercial 3-minute songs, as well as 20-minute songs.
Sure, sure.
And then, you know, he really put all of those together. We spoke about this the last time when Philip
yeah.
and Ralph and myself were here.
Sure.
You know, about, you know, he would be back in the station wagon and making, you know, Ralph drive. They threw me out the car, of course, right? Because I could drive, right?
Yeah.
Because he said, I already did that.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was coming up with concepts then. You know what I mean? And then, you know, then, of course, you know, not, you know, our journey wasn't as always easy. You
yeah,
know,
sure.
you know, we had to break a lot of ground.
Yeah.
And, you know, and by the time he started the group, when he left Ramsey, he was 28.
Yeah.
But then he even mentioned in his book how confident he was, that he had it together. He knew
yeah.
what he wanted to do. And you could feel it, particularly when, you know, I came out here, you know.
Yeah.
And you could feel it when he was Ramsey, that he was on the way,
yeah.
you know.
So you guys are still traveling, still beloved around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Again, ahead of his time
mm-hmm.
for a black band as big as y'all's were,
mm-hmm.
you know, hitting the world stage like that.
Right.
Why was that important to him to get out and see the world with this music?
Because I think, first of all, he was a traveler.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, we went to the pyramids together, Egypt. We went to Israel.
Yeah.
All those great places, Luxor, Egypt, Alexander, Egypt,
yeah.
all the places that, you know, I didn't even know was on the map.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think for him, he was a seeker by nature. And, you know, Reese wasn't like, you know, although he was like a great on stage, he wasn't really like a slap your back. You know, if he loved what you were doing, he would do just like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was kind of like how he did
yeah.
it, you know what I mean? And he was really an inside guy because he had so much going on,
right.
you know, in his thinking, in his soul, you know what I mean? That I think he wanted to take the music and let the whole world see, particularly a group of color,
yeah.
you know what I mean? Because
yeah.
Through our music, they saw our humanity.
Mm-hmm. How did he process, because he didn't speak a lot about this publicly, how did he process discovering that he had an illness?
Little by little, but I noticed it at dinner.
Yeah.
You know, it just came, you know, and I said, oh man, what's going on, you know? And
yeah.
he said, I got a little twitch, and but it got progressed, you know, it was okay for a long time.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
he performed.
Yeah.
You know, it was only, you know, recently
yeah.
that it really, you know, got where he couldn't really do a lot.
Yeah.
But then he retired from the road a lot in 1994.
Sure.
And that was the big thing for, you know, Ralph and Philip and myself to see how we could do
yeah.
without him, you know what I mean? And we got his blessing to go on. It wasn't easy, you know, because, you know, he left a big hole.
You know, Reese left a big hole on stage. You know, we had to have dancers at first, you know, to keep that energy going. You know, we had to grow into it. You know, his aura was so big that we had to grow into that space.
In the book, though, he does question, and maybe even, as I recall, go a little further and says, thinks it was a mistake that he did not replace himself with another lead vocalist when he left the band.
Right.
How did you take that when you read that, when he told you that?
I think originally he thought that, but, you know, Philip, you know, just did it so well and took it so well. And it was actually right, because Philip sang with Reese all those years. So he actually was the only one vocally that knew where Reese was coming from.
Right.
You know, you had to really work with Maurice. You know, like, we worked with Maurice musically.
Yeah.
You know, you had to really be around him to really know where he was coming from. And I don't think another lead person could have done it.
Yeah.
Because they would have done it more like, I'm a fan. Oh, I got to have all your records. Yeah, I got all the records. That's not the person you want.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you want a person that said, we got to go out there and get this.
Right.
You know, and do this and serve. And serve the work and serve the lyrics and the music.
Yeah. Your father was a physician.
Right, Dad.
So early on, I mean, if you guys had followed your initial childhood dreams, you and Reese would have been Dr. Verdeen White and Dr. Maurice White.
Exactly.
You would have been physicians.
Physicians, right.
But somewhere along the way, you guys decided that wasn't the route.
No, now Dad dug music too, though, because he played drums and he was really hip to it. But what happened was he wanted us to be doctors, you know, or lawyers, because you know, that's what we did.
Yeah.
But what that music bug was like, it just was so overwhelming.
Yeah.
You know, I needed it like I needed to breathe.
Yeah.
You know, and then when Reese started to fire, I was in college.
Yeah.
I had a scholarship, man. I was going to be a classical guy. I had it all planned. Make $50,000 a year. I had it together. Then he called and said, listen, you want to come to California? I said, and I sounded like a little girl then because I was young. I said,
yeah.
So it was a totally different world. And then I came out, as I call it, the second great American Revolution.
Yeah.
You know, we had the Women's Lib movement. Mm-hmm. We had Vietnam. We had the Black Power movement all at the same time. Yeah. And the hippies.
Yeah.
And that's really where this concept started in terms of expansion, you know, although it came from Chicago to California.
Sure.
And Reese, you know, he had one rule. He said, man, if you get on drugs, I'm sending you back to Chicago. It was more explicit than that, of course. And so the last time I saw Reese, you know, I was telling him what we were going to do 2016. It's going to be like this. It's going to be like that, you know, and it's going to be a great year. He said, it's going to be a great year. And I said, Reese, let me ask you a question. He said, what? I said, you still going to send me back to Chicago?
After how many years?
45 years. and then he said, I'm thinking about it.
What's amazing about, though, is that your brother, your big brother, brought you out, gave you a chance, he's your brother, so I'm not sure there's a debt there, but how do you process that your older brother invited you out and gave you the life that you've had?
Fear.
Yeah.
Because it was big.
Yeah.
Although it was small to the world, it was big to me.
Yeah.
Because I said, oh, man, I get a chance to work with my brother, man. Yeah. This cat, the great drummer.
Yeah.
I mean, if I blew it, man, it was over.
Yeah.
I was headed back to Chicago. Medical school. Yeah. That was it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the concept was great. You know, plus also too, you had all these great musicians out here, and it was wide open. And then every day, it was always something happening exciting.
Yeah.
He would say, man, we can redo a soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know, with this cat named Melvin Van Peebles.
Yeah.
And that was Sweet Sweetback.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then we signed a deal with Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. Jim Brown was the first manager, the football player, and he was coming off the Dirty Dozen and Muhammad Ali. So, man, a kid out of Chicago, I mean, I met movie stars, you know, that we were actually, they speak, you know?
Yeah.
And then when Clive Davis came, it was like, it was life-changing.
It's beautiful and arresting to be reminded of how much music Reese wrote, not just for the Elements, but for everybody else.
Oh, yeah, man, like Denise.
He wrote so much music.
Ramsey.
Jennifer Holliday.
Neil Diamond. Yeah. You know, hairdresser, he did I Am Love with Jennifer Holliday.
Yeah.
And then even now, man, all the young new artists, man, cats like Chance and Kendrick Lamar, they come up and tell me about songs they heard from their parents.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So he influenced, man, a lot. You know what I mean? So, you know, what he did was great. And this really is a book of testimony of faith, confidence, and believing in yourself and your dreams.
Yeah. Verdeen, good to see you, man.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Actor Jeremy Irons has appeared on stage, TV, and in film, including Reversal of Fortune, for which he won an Oscar, The Lion King, and Law and Order. His recent work includes the film The Man Who Knew Infinity. It's about an Indian mathematics genius whose work revolutionized the discipline in the early 20th century.
Here now, a clip, a scene from the movie The Man Who Knew Infinity.
Let me ask you something. Why do you do it, any of this?
Because I have to. I see it.
Like oil, form for its own sake, an art unto itself. And like all art, it reflects truth. It's the only truth I know. It's my church. And you, just as Mozart could hear an entire symphony in his head, you dance with numbers to infinity. But this dance, this art, does little to endear us to certain factions who see us as mere conjurers. So if we are going to challenge areas of mathematics that are so well trod, we cannot afford to be wrong. I need you to attend your lectures, don't offend your professors, and keep doing your proofs. Otherwise, this experiment of ours will be doomed to failure.
Welcome back, my friend. Good to see you.
It's nice to be here again.
And you're still doing high-quality work.
Well, we try.
Yeah, yeah. I was saying to you before we came on that that I learned a lot about Ramanujan that I didn't know, thanks to the film. But this relationship between you and Dev Patel, who plays Ramanujan, is a powerful
It's very
bonding.
Interesting. I mean, it was set in, true story, set in before the First World War. Mm-hmm. This Indian, young Indian genius mathematician is brought over by a Cambridge professor to Cambridge so they can study his work. Mm-hmm. And young man from, you know, hot climate, just married, and he goes into this Cambridge at the time, was quite racist. Mm-hmm. You know, India was one of our colonies, and the idea that any Indian boy could know more about mathematics, mm-hmm. pure mathematics, than all those guys up at Cambridge. That was a tough one. Mm-hmm. And my character, G.H. Hardy, who brings him over, is a very closed, I mean, he's a genius himself, a mathematical genius, mm-hmm. And probably a little bit aspergic, not great on the old social language. And watching him and Ramanujan sort of come together through this shared passion for pure mathematics, I think is very heartwarming.
Yeah,
seeing a man slowly open up emotionally, you know?
It is heartwarming. What did you learn and what did you make of the fact that, to your earlier point, Jeremy, he was able to buck the system, which is to say, while his other colleagues might not have accepted that this young Indian knew more than they did or as much as they did, but in that time period, he had the courage, my word here, to bring him over anyway.
Well, he just, they were always playing, mathematicians were always playing tricks on each other. They're always pulling jokes on each other. And his initial instinct was that this was some joke from one of his colleagues, these notebooks.
Yeah.
And then he studied them and he thought, no, this is actually extraordinary. So he took them seriously, and the other three or four great mathematicians at Cambridge didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when he got Ramanujan over, and Ramanujan would dream them. Mm-hmm. He'd wake up in the morning and he would describe it, that his goddess mm-hmm. had placed them on his tongue, and he'd know them and he'd write them down. But Hardy, of course, said, you've got to prove it, you've got to write mm-hmm. proofs. Mathematicians have to prove it.
Yeah.
And indeed, some of Ramanujan's theories are still being proved today and are being used for the research into black holes mm-hmm. and into string theory.
Since you raised this scene, Jeremy, one of the things that fascinated me about this particular scene where you and Ramanujan, you and Dev Patel are having this conversation about his faith and about God and how these theories come to him, and you basically say to him, I get that, but you have to prove it. We have to prove it. What I found beautiful about that scene is that I think oftentimes we think that scientists, that mathematicians,
can't be people of faith because we think that the science and the faith are in conflict. Mm. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. It does. And indeed, my character, Hardy, you know, he says, I don't believe in God because I can't prove it.
Yeah, yeah.
But for Ramanujan, God was just part of, you know, his religion, and his mathematics were all bound up together, and his mathematics were given to him by a goddess.
Yeah.
Just a different way of thought.
Yeah.
My feeling, of course, is that it's ludicrous to try to prove God's existence by science. Mm-hmm. God has nothing to do with science.
Yeah.
God is all to do with soul, and who can explain that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, at this point in your career, when you see stuff come across, what's pulling you?
It's, if you're interested in the story,
yeah,
and the character will allow you to go on a journey that you haven't been on before, play a sort of guy you haven't played before, then that's very attractive.
Yeah. And what is it about this guy that you had not played before, and all the things you've done?
Well, I'd never played a mathematician. I'd never played that sort of closed man who, through mathematics, becomes close to someone else who is very passionate about that subject. But also, I have to say, because there is an element, I made a series a long time ago called Brideshead Revisited, and there's an element of G.H. Hardy. You could say, well, he could be, he's a sort of Charles Ryder, a sort of Englishman out of touch with his emotions. But what swung it for me, I met Matthew Brown, the director, came over to Oxford, and we sat, and I'd read the script, and I talked to him, and I thought, this man has such a passion to make this movie, and the same as Ed Pressman did. And Ed served me very well, because, you know, so often you make a movie and it comes out and there isn't that push behind it to really get it to the audience. And I'd seen how Ed and Annie Pressman really work for a film and make sure that it's not forgotten, that it flies.
This question is going to sound like a softball, or anyway, I'll ask it anyway, because I'm really curious as to your thought about this, watching this election season that we are enduring here in the States. And that is this notion of understanding, of acceptance, of friendship, of brotherhood, this relationship that these two characters have, civility. I'm wondering, like, what happened to those kinds of relationships in our society?
Civility, politeness. It's like a cement in a society, binds it together. And when we lose it, then I think we all feel lesser and slightly dirty because of it.
Yeah.
I just think it's good to remind ourselves, you know, not just in society, in marriage.
Yeah.
You know, if a husband and wife are polite to each other, that takes you an awful long way. You're up to 60% before you go any further, you know? And I think we're all so focused on our own route through life and our own pace and what we got to do, we tend to just sort of knock people out of the way and don't care. That's not a way for a society, I think.
Yeah.
So I think there's an element in our film, because it was, I suppose, now a story of 100 years ago, 1913, where we look at those qualities and a lot of people still have those qualities.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's an element of life, with the speed of it, that we tend to let those drop. Kindness, civility, politeness go a long way, I think.
Yeah. The other thing about this film that was fascinating for me is that for a guy who, me, did horribly in math, you too?
Disaster.
You still find the film interesting, even though it brings back nightmares to me about my mathematics class.
I know. But this is what, you see, pure mathematics isn't what we used to do.
Yeah, yeah.
We used to do boring mathematics, which got too complicated, and then we thought, and we went into the arts.
Yeah.
And got other people to add up
for us. Yeah.
But pure mathematics is sort of like, it's something else.
Yeah.
Hardy, my character, wrote a little booklet about mathematics and how he felt about it. And it's like I feel about acting or painting or writing. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. It's much more fluid. It's much more unknown. You can become passionate about it. You are discovering stuff that's out there. And once I read that little booklet called A Mathematician's Apology, I realized he wasn't that unlike me. It's just he spoke a different language. He spoke mathematics, I speak art.
At this point in the game, with all the experience that you have behind you, are you still discovering things about this profession, about your work, about your artistic genius?
My artistic genius. No, I mean, I always feel like a beginner when I start any new project. The profession is changing. This sort of film is becoming more of a rarity. It's what I call an adult film, a film of emotion. It's got no special effects. It's got no things, nothing blowing up. It's just a film about the internal workings of people, which I think our generation find great, and I think many generations find great. But they're harder to make and harder to find as an for an audience. So that's changing. I still love that moment where one's working either with an audience, if it's the theatre, or working with a camera on a particular scene when a particular occurrence is happening. Creating that, I love that moment. But like everything, you know, I spend now 70% of my time selling product and 30% of the time acting. No, actually, 10% of the time acting, 30% of the time hanging around. And 90% of the time, I mean, no, 70, see, I'm not a mathematician. And 70% of the time selling the product.
Well, I'm sorry you had to come sell.
No, it's a pleasure.
But it's never selling when you come. It's just a powerful conversation.
Yeah.
And I'm always enlightened and empowered by our dialogue.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.